Leaving as I did Coalmont around 4 in the afternoon, by Route X, I do not remember the number, I might have made Ramsdale by dawn, had not a shortcut tempted me. I had to get onto Highway Y. My map showed quite blandly that, just beyond Woodbine, which I reached at nightfall, I could leave paved X and reach paved Y by means of a transverse dirt road. It was only some 40 miles long, according to the map. Otherwise, I would have to follow X for another 100 miles, and then use leisurely looping Z to get to Y and my destination. However, the shortcut in question got worse and worse, bumpier and bumpier, muddier and muddier, and when I attempted to turn back after some 10 miles of purblind, tortuous and tortoise-slow progress, my old and weak Melmoth got stuck in deep clay. All was dark and muggy and hopeless. My headlights hung over a broad ditch full of water. The surrounding country, if any, was a black wilderness. I sought to extricate myself, but my rear wheels only whined in slosh and anguish. Cursing my plight, I took off my fancy clothes, changed into slacks, pulled on the bullet-riddled sweater, and waded 4 miles back to a roadside farm. It started to rain on the way, but I had not the strength to go back for a mackintosh. Such incidents have convinced me that my heart is basically sound, despite recent diagnoses. Around midnight, a wrecker dragged my car out. I navigated back to Highway X and travelled on. Utter weariness overtook me an hour later in an anonymous little town. I pulled up at the curb and in darkness drank deep from a friendly flask. The rain had been cancelled miles before. It was a black, warm night somewhere in Appalachia. Now and then cars passed me, red taillights receding, white headlights advancing. But the town was dead. Nobody strolled and laughed on the sidewalks as relaxing burghers would in sweet, mellow, rotting Europe. I was alone to enjoy the innocent night and my terrible thoughts. A wire receptacle on the curb was very particular about acceptable contents. Sweepings, paper, no garbage. Sherry-red letters of light marked a camera shop. A large thermometer with the name of a laxative quietly dwelt on the front of a drugstore. Rubinoff's Jewelry Company had a display of artificial diamonds reflected in a red mirror. A lighted green clock swam in the linenish depths of Jiffy Jeff Laundry. On the other side of the street a garage said in its sleep, "Genuflection Lubricity," and corrected itself to "Gulflex Lubrication." An airplane, also gemmed by Rubinoff, passed droning in the velvety heavens. How many small dead-of-night towns I had seen! This was not yet the last. Let me dally a little. He is as good as destroyed. Some way further across the street, neon lights flickered twice slower than my heart. The outline of a restaurant sign, a large coffee pot, kept bursting every full second or two into emerald life, and every time it went out, pink letters saying "Fine Foods" relayed it, but the pot could still be made out as a latent shadow teasing the eye before its next emerald resurrection. We made shadow graphs. This furtive burg was not far from the Enchanted Hunters. I was weeping again, drunk on the impossible past. At this solitary stop for refreshments between Coalmont and Ramsdale, between innocent Dolly Schiller and jovial Uncle Ivor, I reviewed my case. With the utmost simplicity and clarity I now saw myself and my love. Previous attempts seemed out of focus in comparison. A couple of years before, under the guidance of an intelligent French-speaking confessor to whom, in a moment of metaphysical curiosity, I had turned over a Protestant's drab atheism for an old-fashioned popish cure, I had hoped to deduce from my sense of sin the existence of a supreme being. On those frosty mornings in rime-laced Quebec, the good priest worked on me with the finest tenderness and understanding. I am infinitely obliged to him and the great institution he represented. Alas, I was unable to transcend the simple human fact that whatever spiritual solace I might find, whatever lithophanic eternities might be provided for me, Nothing could make my Lolita forget the foul lust I had inflicted upon her. Unless it can be proven to me as I am now, today, with my heart and my beard and my putrefaction, that in the infinite run it does not matter a jot that a North American girl-child named Dolores Hayes had been deprived of her childhood by a maniac. Unless this can be proven, and if it can, then life is a joke. I see nothing for the treatment of my misery but the melancholy and very local palliative of articulate art. To quote an old poet, "The moral sense in mortals is the duty we have to pay on mortal sense of beauty." There was the day during our first trip, our first circle of paradise, when in order to enjoy my phantasms of peace, I firmly decided to ignore what I could not help perceiving. The fact that I was to her not a boyfriend, not a glamour man, not a pal, not even a person at all, but just two eyes and a foot of engorged brawn, to mention only mentionable matters. There was the day when, having withdrawn the functional promise I had made her on the eve, whatever she had set her funny little heart on, a roller rink with some special plastic floor, or a movie matinee to which she wanted to go alone, I happened to glimpse from the bathroom, through a chance combination of mirror aslant and door ajar, a look on her face. That look I cannot exactly describe, an expression of helplessness so perfect that it seemed to grade into one of rather comfortable inanity, just because this was the very limit of injustice and frustration. And every limit presupposes something beyond it, hence the neutral illumination. And when you bear in mind that these were the raised eyebrows and parted lips of a child, you may better appreciate what depths of calculated carnality, what reflected despair, restrained me from falling at her dear feet and dissolving in human tears, and sacrificing my jealousy to whatever pleasure Lolita might hope to derive from mixing with dirty and dangerous children in an outside world that was real to her. And I have still other smothered memories, now unfolding themselves into limbless monsters of pain. Once, in a sunset-ending street of Beardsley, she turned to little Eva Rosen. I was taking both nymphets to a concert and walking behind them so close as almost to touch them with my person. She turned to Eva, and so very serenely and seriously, in answer to something the other had said about its being better to die than hear Milton Pinsky, some local schoolboy she knew, talk about music, my Lolita remarked, "You know, what's so dreadful about dying is you are completely on your own." And it struck me, as my automaton knees went up and down, that I simply did not know a thing about my darling's mind, and that quite possibly, behind the awful juvenile clichés, there was in her a garden and a twilight, and a palace gate, dim and adorable regions which happened to be lucidly and absolutely forbidden to me, in my polluted rags and miserable convulsions. For I often noticed that living as we did, she and I, in a world of total evil, we would become strangely embarrassed whenever I tried to discuss something she and an older friend, she and a parent, she and a really healthy sweetheart, I and Annabel, Lolita and a sublime, purified, analyzed, deified Harold Hayes, might have discussed. An abstract idea, a painting, stippled Hopkins or Sean Baudelaire, God or Shakespeare, anything of a genuine kind. Goodwill. She would mail her vulnerability in trite brashness and boredom, whereas I, using for my desperately detached comments an artificial tone of voice that set my own last teeth on edge, provoked my audience to such outbursts of rudeness as made any further conversation impossible. Oh, my poor bruised child. I loved you. I was a pentapot monster, but I loved you. I was despicable and brutal and turpid and everything. Mais je t'aimais, je t'aimais. And there were times when I knew how you felt. And it was hell to know it, my little one. Lolita girl, brave Dolly Schiller. I recall certain moments, let us call them icebergs in paradise, when, having had my fill of her, after fabulous, insane exertions that left me limp and azure-barred, I would gather her in my arms with, at last, a mute moan of human tenderness, her skin glistening in the neon light coming from the paved court through the slits in the blind, her soot-black lashes matted, her grave grey eyes more vacant than ever, for all the world a little patient still in the confusion of a drug after a major operation. And the tenderness would deepen to shame and despair, and I would lull and rock my lone light Lolita in my marble arms, and moan in her warm hair, and caress her at random, and mutely ask her blessing. And at the peak of this human, agonized, selfless tenderness, with my soul actually hanging around her naked body and ready to repent, all at once, ironically, horribly, lust would swell again, and, "Oh no," Lolita would say with a sigh to heaven, and the next moment the tenderness and the azure, all would be shattered. Mid-20th century ideas concerning child-parent relationship have been considerably tainted by the scholastic rigmarole and standardized symbols of the psychoanalytic racket. But I hope I am addressing myself to unbiased readers. Once, when Avis's father had honked outside to signal Papa had come to take his pet home, I felt obliged to invite him into the parlour. And he sat down for a minute, and while we conversed, Avis, a heavy, unattractive, affectionate child, drew up to him and eventually perched plumply on his knee. Now, I do not remember if I have mentioned that Lolita always had an absolutely enchanting smile for strangers, a tender, furry slitting of the eyes, a dreamy, sweet radiance of all her features, which did not mean a thing, of course, but was so beautiful, so endearing, that one found it hard to reduce such sweetness to but a magic gene, automatically lighting up her face in atavistic token of some ancient rite of welcome. Hospitable prostitution, the coarse reader may say. Well, there she stood, while Mr. Bird twirled his hat and talked, and... Yes, look how stupid of me. I've left out the main characteristic of the famous Lolita smile, namely, while the tender, nectared, dimpled brightness played, it was never directed at the stranger in the room, but hung in its own remote flowered void, so to speak, or wandered with myopic softness over chance objects. And this is what was happening now. While fat Avis sidled up to her papa, Lolita gently beamed at a fruit knife that she fingered on the edge of the table, whereon she leaned, many miles away from me. Suddenly, as Avis clung to her father's neck and ear, while with a casual arm the man enveloped his lumpy and large offspring, I saw Lolita's smile lose all its light and become a frozen little shadow of itself, and the fruit knife slipped off the table and struck her with its silver handle a freak blow on the ankle which made her gasp and crouch head forward, and then, jumping on one leg, her face awful with the preparatory grimace which children hold till the tears gush, she was gone, to be followed at once and consoled in the kitchen by Avis, who had such a wonderful fat pink dad and a small chubby brother and a brand new baby sister and a home and two grinning dogs, and Lolita had nothing. And I have a neat pendant to that little scene, also in a Beardsley setting. Lolita, who had been reading near the fire, stretched herself and then inquired, her elbow up with a grunt, "Where is she buried, anyway?"
"Who?"
"Oh, you know, my murdered mummy."
"And you know where her grave is," I said, controlling myself. Whereupon I named the cemetery, just outside Ramsdale, between the railway tracks and Lakeview Hill. "Moreover," I added, "the tragedy of such an accident is somewhat cheapened by the epithet you saw fit to apply to it. If you really wish to triumph in your mind over the idea of death..."
"Ray," said Lowe, for hooray, and languidly left the room. And for a long while I stared, with smarting eyes, into the fire. Then I picked up her book. It was some trash for young people. There was a gloomy girl, Marion, and there was her stepmother, who turned out to be, against all expectations, a young, grey, understanding redhead, who explained to Marion that Marion's dead mother had really been a heroic woman, since she had deliberately dissimulated her great love for Marion because she was dying, and did not want her child to miss her.
I did not rush up to her room with cries. I always preferred the mental hygiene of non-interference. Now, squirming and pleading with my own memory, I recall that on this and similar occasions, it was always my habit and method to ignore Lolita's states of mind while comforting my own base self. When my mother, in a livid wet dress under the tumbling mist, so I vividly imagined her, had run panting ecstatically up that ridge above Moulinet to be felled there by a thunderbolt, I was but an infant, and in retrospect no yearnings of the accepted kind could I ever graft upon any moment of my youth. No matter how savagely psychotherapists heckled me in my later periods of depression. But I admit that a man of my power of imagination cannot plead personal ignorance of universal emotions. I may also have relied too much on the abnormally chill relations between Charlotte and her daughter. But the awful point of the whole argument is this. It had become gradually clear to my conventional Lolita during our singular and bestial cohabitation that even the most miserable of family lives was better than the parody of incest, which, in the long run, was the best I could offer the waif. Ramsdale revisited. I approached it from the side of the lake. The sunny noon was all eyes. As I rode by in my mud-flecked car, I could distinguish scintillas of diamond water between the far pines. I turned into the cemetery and walked among the long and short stone monuments. Bonjour, Charlotte. On some of the graves there were pale, transparent little national flags, slumped in the windless air under the evergreens. Gee, Ed, that was bad luck, referring to G. Edward Grammer, a 35-year-old New York office manager who had just been arraigned on a charge of murdering his 33-year-old wife, Dorothy. Bidding for the perfect crime, Ed had bludgeoned his wife and put her into a car. The case came to light when two country policemen on patrol saw Mrs. Grammer's new big blue Chrysler, an anniversary present from her husband, speeding crazily down a hill just inside their jurisdiction. God bless our good cops. The car sideswiped a pole, ran up an embankment covered with beard grass, wild strawberry and cinquefoil, and overturned. The wheels were still gently spinning in the mellow sunlight when the officers removed Mrs. G.'s body. It appeared to be a routine highway accident at first. Alas, the woman's battered body did not match up with only minor damage suffered by the car. I did better. I rolled on. It was funny again to see the slender white church and the enormous elms. Forgetting that in an American suburban street, a lone pedestrian is more conspicuous than a lone motorist, I left the car in the avenue to walk unobtrusively past 342 Lawn Street. Before the great bloodshed, I was entitled to a little relief, to a cathartic spasm of mental regurgitation. Closed were the white shutters of the junk mansion, and somebody had attached a found black velvet hair ribbon to the white for sale sign which was leaning toward the sidewalk. No dog barked. No gardener telephoned. No Miss Opposite sat on the vined porch, where, to the lone pedestrian's annoyance, two ponytailed young women in identical polka-dotted pinafores stopped doing whatever they were doing to stare at him. She was long dead, no doubt. These might be her twin nieces from Philadelphia. Should I enter my old house? As in Turgenev's story, a torrent of Italian music came from an open window, that of the living room. What romantic soul was playing the piano where no piano had plunged and plashed on that bewitched Sunday with the sun on her beloved legs? All at once I noticed that from the lawn I had mown, a golden-skinned, brown-haired nymphette of 9 or 10 in white shorts was looking at me with wild fascination in her large blue-black eyes. I said something pleasant to her, meaning no harm, an old-world compliment, what nice eyes you have. But she retreated in haste, and the music stopped abruptly, and a violent-looking dark man, glistening with sweat, came out and glared at me. I was on the point of identifying myself when, with a pang of dream embarrassment, I became aware of my mud-caked dungarees, my filthy and torn sweater, my bristly chin, my bum's bloodshot eyes. Without saying a word, I turned and plodded back the way I'd come. An aster-like anemic flower grew out of a remembered chink in the sidewalk. Quietly resurrected, Miss Opposite was being wheeled out by her nieces onto her porch, as if it were a stage, and I the star performer. Praying she would not call to me, I hurried to my car. What a steep little street! What a profound avenue! A red ticket showed between wiper and windshield. I carefully tore it into 2, 4, 8 pieces. Feeling I was losing my time, I drove energetically to the downtown hotel where I had arrived with a new bag more than 5 years before. I took a room, made 2 appointments by telephone, shaved, bathed, put on black clothes, and went down for a drink in the bar. Nothing had changed. The barroom was suffused with the same dim, impossible garnet red light that in Europe years ago went with low haunts, but here meant a bit of atmosphere in a family hotel. I sat at the same little table where, at the very start of my stay, immediately after becoming Charlotte's lodger, I had thought fit to celebrate the occasion by suavely sharing with her a half bottle of champagne, which had fatally conquered her poor, brimming heart. As then, a moon-faced waiter was arranging with stellar care 50 sherries on a round tray for a wedding party. Murphy Fantasia, this time. It was 3:08. As I walked through the lobby, I had to skirt a group of ladies who, with mille grâces, were taking leave of each other after a luncheon party. With a harsh cry of recognition, one pounced upon me. She was a stout, short woman in pearl grey with a long grey slim plume to her small hat. It was Mrs. Chatfield. She attacked me with a fake smile all aglow with evil curiosity. Had I done to Dolly, perhaps, what Frank LaSalle, a 50-year-old mechanic, had done to 11-year-old Sally Horner in 1948? Very soon I had that avid glee well under control. She thought I was in California. How was, with exquisite pleasure, I informed her that my stepdaughter had just married a brilliant young mining engineer with a hush-hush job in the Northwest. She said she disapproved of such early marriages. She would never let her Phyllis, who was now 18. "Oh, yes, of course," I said quietly. "I remember Phyllis. Phyllis and Camp Q. Yes, of course. By the way, did she ever tell you how Charlie Holmes debauched there his mother's little charges?" Mrs. Chatfield's already broken smile now disintegrated completely. "For shame," she cried. "For shame, Mr. Humbert. The poor boy has just been killed in Korea." I said, "Didn't she think vient deux with the infinitive expressed recent events so much more neatly than the English just with the past?" "But I had to be trotting off," I said. There were only 2 blocks to Windmuller's office. He greeted me with a very slow, very enveloping, strong, searching grip. He thought I was in California. Had I not lived at one time at Beardsley? His daughter had just entered Beardsley College, and how was... I gave all necessary information about Mrs. Schiller. We had a pleasant business conference. I walked out into the hot September sunshine, a contented pauper. Now that everything had been put out of the way, I could dedicate myself freely to the main object of my visit to Ramsdale. In the methodical manner on which I have always prided myself, I had been keeping Claire Quilty's face masked in my dark dungeon, where he was waiting for me to come with barber and priest. "Réveillez-vous, Lacu, il est temps de mourir." I have no time right now to discuss the mnemonics of physiognomization. I am on my way to his uncle, and walking fast, but let me jot down this. I had preserved in the alcohol of a clouded memory the toad of a face. In the course of a few glimpses, I had noticed its slight resemblance to a cheery and rather repulsive wine-dealer, a relative of mine in Switzerland, with his dumbbells and stinking tricot and fat hairy arms and bald patch and pig-faced servant concubine. He was on the whole a harmless old rascal. Too harmless, in fact, to be confused with my prey. In the state of mind I now found myself, I had lost contact with Trapp's image. It had become completely engulfed by the face of Claire Quilty, as represented with artistic precision by an easeled photograph of him that stood on his uncle's desk. In Beardsley, at the hands of charming Dr. Molnar, I had undergone a rather serious dental operation, retaining only a few upper and lower front teeth. The substitutes were dependent on a system of plates with an inconspicuous wire affair running along my upper gums. The whole arrangement was a masterpiece of comfort, and my canines were in perfect health. However, to garnish my secret purpose with a plausible pretext, I told Dr. Quilty that in hope of alleviating facial neuralgia, I had decided to have all my teeth removed. What would a complete set of dentures cost? How long would the process take, assuming we fixed our first appointment for some time in November? Where was his famous nephew now? Would it be possible to have them all out in one dramatic session? A white-smocked, grey-haired man, with a crew-cut and the big flat cheeks of a politician, Dr. Quilty perched on the corner of his desk, one foot dreamily and seductively rocking as he launched on a glorious long-range plan. He would first provide me with provisional plates until the gum settled. Then he would make me a permanent set. He would like to have a look at that mouth of mine. He wore perforated pied shoes. He had not visited with the rascal since 1946, but supposed he could be found at his ancestral home, Grim Road, not far from Parkington. It was a noble dream. His foot rocked, his gaze was inspired. It would cost me around 600. He suggested he take measurements right away and make the first set before starting operations. My mouth to him was a splendid cave full of priceless treasures, but I denied him entrance. No, I said. On second thoughts, I shall have it all done by Dr. Molnar. His price is higher, but he, of course, is a much better dentist than you. I do not know if any of my readers will ever have a chance to say that. It is a delicious dream feeling. Claire's uncle remained sitting on the desk, still looking dreamy, but his foot had stopped push-rocking the cradle of rosy anticipation. On the other hand, his nurse, a skeleton-thin, faded girl, with the tragic eyes of unsuccessful blondes, rushed after me so as to be able to slam the door in my wake. "Push the magazine into the butt. Press home until you hear or feel the magazine catch engage. Delightfully snug. Capacity, 8 cartridges. Full blued. Aching to be discharged." A gas station attendant in Parkington explained to me very clearly how to get to Grim Road. Wishing to be sure Quilty would be at home, I attempted to ring him up, but learned that his private telephone had recently been disconnected. Did that mean he was gone? I started to drive to Grim Road, 12 miles north of the town. By that time, night had eliminated most of the landscape, and as I followed the narrow, winding highway, a series of short posts, ghostly white, with reflectors, borrowed my own lights to indicate this or that curve. I could make out a dark valley on one side of the road and wooded slopes on the other, and in front of me, like derelict snowflakes, moths drifted out of the blackness into my probing aura. At the 12th mile, as foretold, a curiously hooded bridge sheathed me for a moment, and beyond it a whitewashed rock loomed on the right, and a few car lengths further, on the same side, I turned off the highway up gravelly Grim Road. For a couple of minutes all was dank, dark, dense forest, then Pava Manor. A wooden house with a turret arose in a circular clearing. Its windows glowed yellow and red, its drive was cluttered with half a dozen cars. I stopped in the shelter of the trees and abolished my lights to ponder the next move quietly. He would be surrounded by his henchmen and whores. I could not help seeing the inside of that festive and ramshackle castle in terms of troubled teens, a story in one of her magazines. Vague orgies, a sinister adult with pineal cigar, drugs, bodyguards. At least he was there. I would return in the torpid morning. Gently I rolled back to town in that old faithful car of mine which was serenely, almost cheerfully working for me. My Lolita. There was still a 3-year-old bobby pin of hers in the depths of the glove compartment. There was still that stream of pale moths siphoned out of the night by my headlights. Dark barns still propped themselves up here and there by the roadside. People were still going to the movies. While searching for night lodgings, I passed the drive-in, in a Selenian glow, truly mystical in its contrast with the moonless and massive night, on a gigantic screen slanting away among the drowsy fields. A thin phantom raised a gun, both he and his arm reduced to tremulous dishwater by the oblique angle of that receding world, and the next moment a row of trees shut off the gesticulation. I left Insomnia Lodge next morning around 8 and spent some time in Parkington. Visions of bungling the execution kept obsessing me. Thinking that perhaps the cartridges in the automatic had gone stale during a week of inactivity, I removed them and inserted a fresh batch. Such a thorough oil bath did I give Chum that now I couldn't get rid of the stuff. I bandaged him up with a rag like a maimed limb, and used another rag to wrap up a handful of spare bullets. A thunderstorm accompanied me most of the way back to Grim Road, but when I reached Pava Manor, the sun was visible again, burning like a man, and the birds screamed in the drenched and steaming trees. The elaborate and decrepit house seemed to stand in a kind of daze, reflecting, as it were, my own state, for I could not help realizing, as my feet touched the springy and insecure ground, that I had overdone the alcoholic stimulation business. A guardedly ironic silence answered my bell. The garage, however, was loaded with his car, a black convertible for the nonce. I tried the knocker. A ree nobody. With a petulant snarl, I pushed the front door, and, how nice, it swung open as in a medieval fairy tale. Having softly closed it behind me, I made my way across a spacious and very ugly hall, peered into an adjacent drawing-room, noticed a number of used glasses growing out of the carpet, and decided that Master was still asleep in the master bedroom. So I trudged upstairs. My right hand clutched muffled Chum in my pocket. My left patted the sticky banisters. Of the 3 bedrooms I inspected, one had obviously been slept in that night. There was a library full of flowers. There was a rather bare room with ample and deep mirrors and a polar bear skin on the slippery floor. There were still other rooms. A happy thought struck me. If and when Master returned from his constitutional in the woods, or emerged from some secret lair, it might be wise for an unsteady gunman with a long job before him to prevent his playmate from locking himself up in a room. Consequently, for at least 5 minutes I went about, lucidly insane, crazily calm, an enchanted and very tight hunter, turning whatever keys and whatever locks there were, and pocketing them with my free left hand. The house, being an old one, had more planned privacy than have modern glamour boxes, where the bathroom, the only lockable locus, has to be used for the furtive needs of planned parenthood. Speaking of bathrooms, I was about to visit a third one when Master came out of it, leaving a brief waterfall behind him. The corner of a passage did not quite conceal me. Grey-faced, baggy-eyed, fluffily dishevelled in a scanty, balding way, but still perfectly recognisable, he swept by me in a purple bathrobe, very like one I had. He either did not notice me, or else dismissed me as some familiar and innocuous hallucination, and showing me his hairy calves, he proceeded, sleepwalker-wise, downstairs. I pocketed my last key and followed him into the entrance hall. He had half opened his mouth and the front door to peer out through a sunny chink as one who thinks he has heard a half-hearted visitor ring and recede. Then, still ignoring the rain-coated phantasm that had stopped in mid-stairs, Master walked into a cosy boudoir across the hall from the drawing-room, through which, taking it easy, knowing he was safe, I now went away from him, and in a bar-adorned kitchen gingerly unwrapped dirty Chum, taking care not to leave any oily stains on the chrome. I think I got the wrong product. It was black and awfully messy. In my usual meticulous way, I transferred naked Chum to a clean recess about me and made for the little boudoir. My step, as I say, was springy. Too springy, perhaps, for success, but my heart pounded with tiger joy as I crunched a cocktail glass underfoot. Master met me in the Oriental parlour. "Now who are you?" he asked in a high, hoarse voice, his hands thrust into his dressing-gown pockets, his eyes fixing a point to the northeast of my head. "Are you by any chance Brewster?" By now it was evident to everybody that he was in a fog and completely at my so-called mercy. I could enjoy myself. "That's right," I answered suavely. "Je suis Monsieur Brewster. Let us chat for a moment before we start." He looked pleased. His smudgy moustache twitched. I removed my raincoat. I was wearing a black suit, black shirt, no tie. We sat down in two easy chairs. "You know," he said, scratching loudly his fleshy and gritty grey cheek, and showing his small pearly teeth in a crooked grin, "you don't look like Jack Brewster. I mean, the resemblance is not particularly striking. Somebody told me he had a brother with the same telephone company." To have him trapped, after those years of repentance and rage, to look at the black hairs on the back of his pudgy hands, to wander with 100 eyes over his purple silks and hirsute chest, foreglimpsing the punctures and mess and music of pain, to know that this semi-animated, subhuman trickster who had sodomized my darling, oh, my darling, this was intolerable bliss. No, I'm afraid I'm neither of the Brewsters. He cocked his head, looking more pleased than ever. Guess again, Punch.
Ah, said Punch, so you've not come to bother me about those long-distance calls.
You do make them once in a while, don't you?
Excuse me?
I thought he had said he had never...
People, he said, people in general. I'm not accusing you, Brewster. But you know it's absurd the way people invade this damned house without even knocking. They use the water, they use the kitchen, they use the telephone. Phil calls Philadelphia, Pat calls Patagonia. Well, I refuse to pay. You have a funny accent, Captain.
Quilty, I said, do you recall a little girl called Dolores Hayes? Dolly Hayes. Dolly called Dolores Collo.
Sure, she may have made those calls, sure, any place, Paradise, Washington, Hell Canyon, who cares?
I do, Quilty. You see, I am her father.
Nonsense, he said, you are not, you are some foreign literary agent. A Frenchman once translated my proud flesh as La Fierté de la Chair.
Absurd, she was my child, Quilty. In the state he was in, he could not really be taken aback by anything. But his blustering manner was not quite convincing. A sort of wary inkling kindled his eyes into a semblance of life. They were immediately dulled again.
"I am very fond of children myself," he said, "and fathers are among my best friends."
He turned his head away, looking for something. He beat his pockets. He attempted to rise from his seat.
"Down," I said, apparently much louder than I intended. "You need not roar at me," he complained in his strange feminine manner. "I just wanted a smoke. I'm dying for a smoke."
"You're dying, anyway."
"Oh, shucks," he said. "You begin to bore me. What do you want? Are you French, mister? Woolly wooboar? Let's go to the Borumet and have a stiff."
He saw the little dark weapon lying in my palm, as if I were offering it to him.
"Say," he drawled, now imitating the underworld numbskull of movies, "that's a swell little gun you've got there. What do you want for her?"
I slapped down his outstretched hand, and he managed to knock over a box on the low table near him. It ejected a handful of cigarettes.
"Here they are," he said cheerfully. "You recall Kipling? Un femme et un caporelet un cigarette. Now we need matches."
"Quilty," I said, "I want you to concentrate. You are going to die in a moment. The hereafter, for all we know, may be an internal state of excruciating insanity. You smoked your last cigarette yesterday. Concentrate. Try to understand what is happening to you." He kept taking the drone cigarette apart and munching bits of it.
"I'm willing to try," he said. You are either Australian or a German refugee. Must you talk to me? This is a Gentile's house, you know. Maybe you'd better run along, and do stop demonstrating that gun. I've an old Stern Luger in the music room. I pointed Chum at his slippered foot and crushed the trigger. It clicked. He looked at his foot, at the pistol, again at his foot. I made another awful effort, and with a ridiculously feeble and juvenile sound, it went off. The bullet entered the thick pink rug, and I had the paralyzing impression that it had merely trickled in and might come out again.
"See what I mean?" said Quilty. "You should be a little more careful. Give me that thing, for Christ's sake."
He reached for it. I pushed him back into the chair. The rich joy was waning. It was high time I destroyed him, but he must understand why he was being destroyed. His condition infected me. The weapon felt limp and clumsy in my hand. "Concentrate," I said, "on the thought of Dolly Hayes, whom you kidnapped."
"I did not," he cried. "You're all wet. I saved her from a beastly pervert. Show me your badge instead of shooting at my foot, you ape, you. Where is that badge? I'm not responsible for the rapes of others. Absurd. That joyride, I grant you, was a silly stunt, but you got her back, didn't you? Come, let's have a drink."
I asked him whether he wanted to be executed sitting or standing.
"Ah, let me think," he said. "It's not an easy question. Incidentally, I made a mistake, which I sincerely regret. You see, I had no fun with your Dolly. I'm practically impotent to tell the melancholy truth, and I gave her a splendid vacation. She met some remarkable people. Do you happen to know—"
And with a tremendous lurch he fell all over me, sending the pistol hurtling under a chest of drawers. Fortunately, he was more impetuous than vigorous, and I had little difficulty in shoving him back into his chair. He puffed a little and folded his arms on his chest.
"Now you've done it," he said.
"Vous voilà dans le beau drap, mon vieux." His French was improving. I looked around. Perhaps I could, on my hands and knees, risk it.
"Alors, que fait-on?"
he asked, watching me closely. I stooped. He did not move. I stooped lower.
"My dear sir," he said, "stop trifling with life and death. I am a playwright. I have written tragedies, comedies, fantasies. I have made private movies out of Justine and other 18th-century sexcapades. I'm the author of 52 successful scenarios. I know all the ropes. Let me handle this. There should be a poker somewhere. Why don't I fetch it, and then we'll fish out your property?"
Fussily, busybodily, cunningly, he had risen again while he talked. I groped under the chest, trying at the same time to keep an eye on him. All of a sudden I noticed that he had noticed that I did not seem to have noticed Chum protruding from beneath the other corner of the chest. We fell to wrestling again. We rolled all over the floor, in each other's arms, like two huge, helpless children. He was naked and goatish under his robe, and I felt suffocated as he rolled over me. I rolled over him. We rolled over me. They rolled over him. We rolled over us. In its published form, this book is being read, I assume, in the first years of 2000 AD. 1935 plus 80 or 90. Live long, my love. And elderly readers will surely recall at this point the obligatory scene in the westerns of their childhood. Our tussle, however, lacked the ox-stunning fisticuffs, the flying furniture. He and I were two large dummies, stuffed with dirty cotton and rags. It was a silent, soft, formless tussle on the part of two literati, one of whom was utterly disorganized by a drug, while the other was handicapped by a heart condition and too much gin. When at last I had possessed myself of my precious weapon, and the scenario writer had been reinstalled in his low chair, both of us were panting as the cowman and the sheepman never do after their battle. I decided to inspect the pistol. Our sweat might have spoiled something, and regain my wind before proceeding to the main item on the program. To fill in the pause, I proposed he read his own sentence in the poetical form I had given it. The term poetical justice is one that may be most happily used in this respect. I handed him a neat typescript.
"Yes," he said, "splendid idea. Let me fetch my reading glasses. He attempted to rise. No.
Just as you say. Shall I read out loud?
Yes.
Here goes.
I see it's in verse.
Because you took advantage of a sinner, because you took advantage, because you took advantage of my disadvantage. That's good, you know, that's damn good. When I stood Adam naked before a federal law and all its stinging stars. Oh, grand stuff. Because you took advantage of a sin when I was helpless, molting, moist and tender, hoping for the best, dreaming of marriage in a mountain state, I of a litter of Lolitas. I didn't get that. Because you took advantage of my inner essential innocence, because you cheated me, a little repetitious, what? Where was I? Because you cheated me of my redemption, because you took her at the age when lads play with erector sets. Getting smutty, eh? A little downy girl still wearing poppies, still eating popcorn in the colored gloam, where tawny Indians took paid croppers. Because you stole her from her wax-browed and dignified protector, spitting into his heavy-lidded eye, ripping his flabbed toga, and at dawn leaving the hog to roll upon his new discomfort, the awfulness of love and violets, remorse, despair, while you took a dull doll to pieces and threw its head away, because of all you did, because of all I did not, you have to die. Well, sir, this is certainly a fine poem. Your best, as far as I'm concerned.
He folded it and handed it back to me. I asked him if he had anything serious to say before dying. The automatic was again ready for use on the person. He looked at me and heaved a big sigh.
Now, look here, Mac, he said. You are drunk and I am a sick man. Let us postpone the matter. I need quiet. I have to nurse my impotence. Friends are coming in the afternoon to take me to a game. This pistol-packing farce is becoming a frightful nuisance. We are men of the world in everything, sex, free verse, marksmanship. You bear me a grudge. I am ready to make unusual amends. Even an old-fashioned rencontre, sword or pistol, in Rio or elsewhere, is not excluded. My memory and my eloquence are not at their best today, but really, my dear Mr. Humbert, you were not an ideal stepfather, and I did not force your little protégé to join me. It was she made me remove her to a happier home. This house is not as modern as that ranch we shared with dear friends, but it is roomy, cool in summer and winter, and in a word, comfortable. So, since I intend retiring to England or Florence forever, I suggest you move in. It is yours, gratis. Under the condition you stop pointing at me that... he swore disgustingly, gun. By the way, I do not know if you care for the bizarre, but if you do, I can offer you also gratis, as house pet, a rather exciting little freak, a young lady with three breasts, one a dandy. This is a rare and delightful marvel of nature. Now, soyons raisonnables. You will only wound me hideously, and then rot in jail while I recuperate in a tropical setting. I promise you, Brewster, you will be happy here, with a magnificent cellar and all the royalties of my next play. I have not much at the bank right now, but I propose to borrow, you know, as the bard said, with that cold in his head, to borrow and to borrow and to borrow. There are other advantages. We have here a most reliable and bribable charwoman, a Miss Vibrisser, curious name, who comes from the village twice a week. Alas, not today. She has daughters, granddaughters. A thing or two I know about the chief of police makes him my slave. I am a playwright. I have been called the American Maeterlinck. Maeterlinck Schmetterlinck says I come on. Oh, this is very humiliating. I'm not sure I'm doing the right thing. Never use Herculaneter with rum. Now, drop that pistol like a good fellow. I knew your dear wife slightly. You may use my wardrobe. Oh, another thing, you're going to like this. I have an absolutely unique collection of erotica upstairs. Just to mention one item, the in-folio deluxe Bagration Island by the explorer and psychoanalyst Melanie Weiss. A remarkable lady, a remarkable work. Drop that gun.
with photographs of 800-and-something male organs she examined and measured in 1932 on Bagration in the Barder Sea, very illuminating graphs, plotted with love under pleasant skies. Drop that gun! And moreover, I can arrange for you to attend executions. Not everybody knows the chair is painted yellow. Phew!
This time I hit something hard. I hit the back of a black rocking chair, not unlike Dolly Schiller's. My bullet hit the inside surface of its back, whereupon it immediately went into a rocking act, so fast and with such zest that anyone coming into the room might have been flabbergasted by the double miracle. That chair rocking in a panic all by itself, and the armchair, where my purple target had just been, now void of all live content. Wiggling his fingers in the air, with a rapid heave of his rump, he flashed into the music room, and the next second we were tugging and gasping on both sides of the door, which had a key I had overlooked. I won again, and with another abrupt movement, Claire the Unpredictable sat down before the piano and played several atrociously vigorous, fundamentally hysterical, plangent chords, his jowls quivering, his spread hands tensely plunging, and his nostrils emitting the soundtrack snorts which had been absent from our fight. Still singing those impossible sonorities, he made a futile attempt to open with his foot a kind of seaman's chest near the piano. My next bullet caught him somewhere in the side, and he rose from his chair higher and higher like old grey mad Nijinsky, like old faithful, like some old nightmare of mine, to a phenomenal altitude, or so it seemed, as he rent the air, still shaking with the rich black music, head thrown back in a howl, hand pressed to his brow, and with his other hand clutching his armpit as if stung by a hornet, down he came on his heels, and again a normal robed man scurried out into the hall. I see myself following him through the hall with a kind of double, triple kangaroo jump, remaining quite straight on straight legs while bouncing up twice in his wake, and then bouncing between him and the front door in a ballet-like stiff bounce, with the purpose of heading him off, since the door was not properly closed. Suddenly dignified and somewhat morose, he started to walk up the broad stairs, and shifting my position but not actually following him up the steps, I fired three or four times in quick succession, wounding him at every blaze. And every time I did it to him, that horrible thing to him, his face would twitch in an absurd clownish manner, as if he were exaggerating the pain. He slowed down, rolled his eyes, half-closing them, and made a feminine, ah! And he shivered every time a bullet hit him, as if I were tickling him. And every time I got him with those slow, clumsy, blind bullets of mine, he would say under his breath, with a phony British accent all the while, dreadfully twitching, shivering, smirking, but withal talking in a curiously detached and even amiable manner, "Ah, that hurts, sir, enough. Ah, that hurts atrociously, my dear fellow. I pray you desist. Ah, very painful indeed. God, ah, this is abominable. You should really not." His voice trailed off as he reached the landing. But he steadily walked on, despite all the lead I had lodged in his bloated body. And in distress, in dismay, I understood that far from killing him, I was injecting spurts of energy into the poor fellow, as if the bullets had been capsules wherein a heady elixir danced. I reloaded the thing with hands that were black and bloody. I had touched something he had anointed with his thick gore. Then I rejoined him upstairs, the keys jangling in my pockets like gold. He was trudging from room to room, bleeding majestically, trying to find an open window, shaking his head, and still trying to talk me out of murder. I took aim at his head, and he retired to the master bedroom with a burst of royal purple where his ear had been. Get out of here, he said, coughing and spitting, and in a nightmare of wonder I saw this blood-spattered but still buoyant person get into his bed and wrap himself up in the chaotic bedclothes. I hit him at very close range through the blankets, and then he lay back, and a big pink bubble with juvenile connotations formed on his lips, grew to the size of a toy ballon, and vanished. I may have lost contact with reality for a second or two. Oh, nothing of the "I just blacked out" sort that your common criminal enacts. On the contrary, I want to stress the fact that I was responsible for every shed drop of his bubble blood. But a kind of momentary shift occurred, as if I were in the connubial bedroom, and Charlotte was sick in bed. Quilty was a very sick man. I held one of his slippers instead of the pistol. I was sitting on the pistol.
Then I made myself a little more comfortable in the chair near the bed and consulted my wristwatch. The crystal was gone, but it ticked. The whole sad business had taken more than an hour. He was quiet at last. Far from feeling any relief, a burden even weightier than the one I had hoped to get rid of was with me, upon me, over me. I could not bring myself to touch him in order to make sure he was really dead. He looked it, a quarter of his face gone and two flies beside themselves with a dawning sense of unbelievable luck. My hands were hardly in better condition than his. I washed up as best I could in the adjacent bathroom. Now I could leave. As I emerged on the landing, I was amazed to discover that a vivacious buzz I had just been dismissing as a mere singing in my ears was really a medley of voices and radio music coming from the downstairs drawing room. I found there a number of people who apparently had just arrived and were cheerfully drinking Quilty's liquor. There was a fat man in an easy chair, and two dark-haired, pale young beauties, sisters, no doubt, big one and small one, almost a child, demurely sat side by side on a davenport. A florid-faced fellow with sapphire-blue eyes was in the act of bringing two glasses out of the bar-like kitchen, where two or three women were chatting and chinking ice. I stopped in the doorway and said, "I've just killed Claire Quilty." "Good for you," said the florid fellow as he offered one of the drinks to the elder girl. "Somebody ought to have done it long ago," remarked the fat man.
"What does he say, Tony?"
asked a faded blonde from the bar.
"He says," answered the florid fellow, "he has killed Q."
"Well," said another unidentified man, rising in a corner where he'd been crouching to inspect some records, "I guess we all should do it to him some day." "Anyway," said Tony, "he'd better come down. We can't wait for him much longer if we want to get to that game."
"Give this man a drink, somebody,"
said the fat person. "Want a beer?" said a woman in slacks, showing it to me from afar. Only the two girls on the davenport, both wearing black, the younger fingering a bright something about her white neck, only they said nothing but just smiled on, so young, so lewd. As the music paused for a moment, there was a sudden noise on the stairs. Tony and I stepped out into the hall. Quilty, of all people, had managed to crawl out onto the landing, and there we could see him, flapping and heaving, and then subsiding, forever this time, in a purple heap.
"Hurry up, Q," said Tony with a laugh. "I believe he's still..."
He returned to the drawing-room. Music drowned the rest of the sentence. This, I said to myself, was the end of the ingenious play staged for me by Quilty. With a heavy heart I left the house and walked through the spotted blaze of the sun to my car. Two other cars were parked on both sides of it, and I had some trouble squeezing out. The rest is a little flattish and faded. Slowly I drove downhill, and presently found myself going at the same lazy pace in a direction opposite to Parkington. I had left my raincoat in the boudoir and Chum in the bathroom. No, it was not a house I would have liked to live in. I wondered idly if some surgeon of genius might not alter his own career, and perhaps the whole destiny of mankind, by reviving Quilted Quilty. Claire Obscure. Not that I cared. On the whole, I wished to forget the whole mess. And when I did learn he was dead, the only satisfaction it gave me was the relief of knowing I need not mentally accompany for months a painful and disgusting convalescence, interrupted by all kinds of unmentionable operations and relapses, and perhaps an actual visit from him, with trouble on my part to rationalize him as not being a ghost. Thomas had something. It is strange that the tactile sense, which is so infinitely less precious to men than sight, becomes at critical moments our main, if not only, handle to reality. I was all covered with Quilty, with the feel of that tumble before the bleeding. The road now stretched across open country, and it occurred to me, not by way of protest, not as a symbol or anything like that, but merely as a novel experience, that since I had disregarded all laws of humanity, I might as well disregard the rules of traffic. So I crossed to the left side of the highway and checked the feeling, and the feeling was good. It was a pleasant diaphragmal melting, with elements of diffused tactility. All this enhanced by the thought that nothing could be nearer to the elimination of basic physical laws than deliberately driving on the wrong side of the road. In a way, it was a very spiritual itch. Gently, dreamily, not exceeding 20 miles an hour, I drove on that queer mirror side. Traffic was light. Cars that now and then passed me on the side I had abandoned to them honked at me brutally. Cars coming towards me wobbled, swerved, and cried out in fear. Presently I found myself approaching populated places. Passing through a red light was like a sip of forbidden burgundy when I was a child. Meanwhile, complications were arising. I was being followed and escorted. Then, in front of me, I saw two cars placing themselves in such a manner as to completely block my way. With a graceful movement, I turned off the road, and after two or three big bounces, rode up a grassy slope among surprised cows, and there I came to a gentle, rocking stop. A kind of thoughtful Hegelian synthesis linking up two dead women. I was soon to be taken out of the car. "Hi, Melmoth, thanks a lot, old fellow." And was indeed looking forward to surrender myself to many hands, without doing anything to cooperate, while they moved and carried me, relaxed, comfortable, surrendering myself lazily, like a patient, and deriving an eerie enjoyment from my limpness and the absolutely reliable support given me by the police and the ambulance people. And while I was waiting for them to run up to me on the high slope, I evoked a last mirage of wonder and hopelessness. One day, soon after her disappearance, an attack of abominable nausea forced me to pull up on the ghost of an old mountain road that now accompanied, now traversed, a brand new highway, with its population of asters bathing in the detached warmth of the pale blue afternoon in late summer. After coughing myself inside out, I rested a while on a boulder, and then, thinking the sweet air might do me good, walked a little way toward a low stone parapet on the precipice side of the highway. Small grasshoppers spurted out of the withered roadside weeds. A very light cloud was opening its arms and moving towards a slightly more substantial one belonging to another, more sluggish, heaven-logged system. As I approached the friendly abyss, I grew aware of a melodious unity of sounds rising like vapour from a small mining town that lay at my feet in a fold of the valley. One could make out the geometry of the streets between blocks of red and grey roofs, and green puffs of trees, and a serpentine stream, and the rich ore-like glitter of the city dump, and beyond the town, roads crisscrossing the crazy quilt of dark and pale fields, and behind it all, great timbered mountains. But even brighter than those quietly rejoicing colours, for there are colours and shades that seem to enjoy themselves in good company, both brighter and dreamier to the ear than they were to the eye, was that vapoury vibration of accumulated sounds that never ceased for a moment as it rose to the lip of granite where I stood wiping my foul mouth. And soon I realised that all these sounds were of one nature, that no other sounds but these came from the streets of the transparent town, with the women at home and the men away. Reader, what I heard was but the melody of children at play, nothing but that. And so limpid was the air that within this vapour of blended voices, majestic and minute, remote and magically near, frank and divinely enigmatic, one could hear now and then, as if released, an almost articulate spurt of vivid laughter, or the crack of a bat, or the clatter of a toy wagon. But it was all really too far for the eye to distinguish any movement in the lightly etched streets. I stood listening to that musical vibration from my lofty slope, to those flashes of separate cries with a kind of demure murmur for background, and then I knew that the hopelessly poignant thing was not Lolita's absence from my side, but the absence of her voice from that concord. This, then, is my story. I have reread it. It has bits of marrow sticking to it, and blood, and beautiful bright green flies. At this or that twist of it, I feel my slippery self eluding me, gliding into deeper and darker waters than I care to probe. I have camouflaged what I could, so as not to hurt people. And I have toyed with many pseudonyms for myself before I hit on a particularly apt one. There are in my notes Otto Otto and Mesmer Mesmer and Lambert Lambert. But for some reason I think my choice expresses the nastiness best. When I started 56 days ago to write Lolita, first in the psychopathic ward for observation and then in this well-heated, albeit tumult, seclusion, I thought I would use these notes in toto at my trial, to save not my head, of course, but my soul. In mid-composition, however, I realized that I could not parade living Lolita. I may still use parts of this memoir in hermetic sessions, but publication is to be deferred. For reasons that may appear more obvious than they really are, I'm opposed to capital punishment. This attitude will be, I trust, shared by the sentencing judge. Had I come before myself, I would have given Humbert at least 35 years for rape and dismissed the rest of the charges. But even so, Dolly Schiller will probably survive me by many years. The following decision I make with all the legal impact and support of a signed testament. I wish this memoir to be published only when Lolita is no longer alive. Thus, neither of us is alive when the reader opens this book. But while the blood still throbs through my writing hand, you are still as much part of blessed matter as I am, and I can still talk to you from here to Alaska. Be true to your Dick. Do not let other fellows touch you. Do not talk to strangers. I hope you will love your baby. I hope it will be a boy. That husband of yours, I hope, will always treat you well, because otherwise my spectre shall come at him like black smoke, like a demented giant, and pull him apart nerve by nerve. And do not pity CQ. One had to choose between him and HH, and one wanted HH to exist at least a couple of months longer so as to have him make you live in the minds of later generations. I'm thinking of aurochs and angels, the secret of durable pigments, prophetic sonnets, the refuge of art. And this is the only immortality you and I may share, my Lolita.